You have people who give up before the process even starts. They say, I'm not even going to press charges because I know that nothing will come of it.
Legislation to help strengthen public safety in tribal communities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 22nd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, police take another look at a 30-year-old murder case.
All of us have been hanging by a thread all these years, waiting for a news almost any day to break that they had solved the case.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
A new law aimed at improving justice and safety for Alaska Natives and Native Americans is awaiting President Obama's signature. The Tribal Law and Order Act won bipartisan support and passed the U.S. House yesterday. The president says he will sign it, and in a written statement called it an important step to help the federal government better address public safety challenges confronting tribal communities. It mostly relates to reservation lands and Indian country outside Alaska, but Senator Lisa Murkowski, who sits on the Indian Affairs Committee, says the bill also helps Alaska.
It is a small slice, but I think it is important for us. I think two issues here that rise to the top. First is the assistance with the VPSO positions.
It allows the state and tribal nonprofits that employ VPSOs or Village Public Safety Officers to apply for federal grants. Currently, the VPSO jobs are only funded through state or congressional earmarks. It also lets the VPSOs train at the Indian Policy Academy in New Mexico. Murkowski says one of the big problems with prosecuting serious sexual assault crimes, both in Alaska and on reservations, is the inability to collect and process forensic evidence. The bill calls for the research wing of Congress to evaluate the Indian Health Service facilities and how evidence is dealt with. Murkowski says that's a basic first step toward protecting women.
If you can't do the prosecution, you have people in communities who give up before the process even starts. They say, I'm not even going to press charges because I know that nothing will come of it. And the cycle continues and it mounts.
But one item that would have been a big help to Alaska tribes was stripped out of the bill. It would have called for a $50 million pilot project to allow Alaska tribes to create cooperative partnerships with the state and federal government. The project would have enhanced the authority of tribal courts to locally address sexual assault, domestic violence, and drug and alcohol-related crimes. Murkowski says she'll look for other ways to advance the demonstration project. The director of the state of Alaska's Washington, D.C. office, John Katz, says it was important to the state that Alaska tribes were not given increased criminal jurisdiction as a byproduct. Most of Alaska's tribes are not considered part of Indian country and so don't have the same jurisdictional oversight. Katz says the state got on board once that was acknowledged in the bill.
The Senate bill includes a disclaimer that we supported that we think makes it clear that there's no expansion of Indian country or tribal jurisdiction beyond Indian country in Alaska.
All three members of Alaska's delegation voted for the Tribal Law and Order Act, despite their party differences. Reaction to the bill from Alaska tribal advocates is mixed. Natalie Landreth is an attorney for the Native American Rights Fund. Landreth says many interior villages will be happy to be able to access federal funding again, but she says there is still a gaping hole in the problem of rural justice.
What do you do if you have a DV offender in a community and the tribe's not allowed to serve him with a protective order, not allowed to keep him out, and they can't get someone on the phone to come remove him? You've still got that problem even after this bill.
Landreth says the pilot project that was stripped out of the bill came from recommendations of the Rural Justice Commission in a report from 2005.
It's a recommendation at its core that says local problems can be solved at the local level if these Native communities will be provided with the acknowledgement of their authority or an acknowledgement of their ability to act and some financial support to get there. The project would not have done that for every tribe in Alaska. It would have said, let's just try it and see how it works.
Landreth says the project would not have authorized all tribal communities to have this authority, but it would have given 18 to 30 tribes five-year grants to come up with new ways to deal with sexual assault, domestic violence, and drug and alcohol crimes. A murder that took place almost 30 years ago in Kodiak remains unsolved. Fisherman Thomas Carbine was found dead in the parking lot of the Beachcomber Bar around 3:30 in the morning on July 15, 1982. Diana Gish of KMXT in Kodiak has more.
The unsolved murder case has been receiving a lot of attention lately. Jim Stogstill of the Alaska Bureau of Investigation explained that even though the crime was committed almost three decades ago, the case was never closed.
As most of our homicides are, even though they're unsolved, we really don't close them. They might become inactive and not much work being done on them, but they're always open. So reopening really isn't a true statement, I suppose.
James Carbine is the father of Thomas Carbine. He's always been baffled that his son's murder could go unsolved in such a small, close-knit community. The elder Carbine is 85 years old now and is still hoping that the murderer will be caught. He said he's not sure what it will mean to him, but he still remains hopeful.
Well, there's no question that all of us have been hanging by a thread all these years, waiting for a news almost any day to break that they had solved the case. And so what does it mean? I don't know, because we've been on this string for so long, 28 years, that we almost have to got to feel that the police will never be able to solve it. It does affect our family very seriously. We never go a day without thinking about them.
Sharon Carbine is an attorney and Thomas Carbine's cousin. She was 32 years old when his life was cut short at age 27. She has an interest in cold case files and thought it was time to look closer into Thomas's.
It's getting close to 30 years since Tom was killed. And so anybody who was around at the time of his murder, they're a lot older now, and their circumstances have changed. And I'm just really, really hoping that somebody will come forward and give some hints to the investigator who's working on the case.
Thomas Carbine had been fishing in Bristol Bay when the boat he was working on broke down. It's thought that he came to Kodiak in search of another job while the vessel was being repaired. Carbine spent the evening at the Beachcomber Bar in Kodiak on that July night in 1982. He was buying rounds of drinks up until the time he decided to leave. At that point, apparently, someone followed him out of the bar and stabbed him, taking his money and all of his identification. Investigator Stogstill says that even though it's been so many years since the murder, it's not unusual for information to surface after the fact.
You know, here's a crime that occurred a really long time ago. Everybody's much older now. This fellow was killed in the parking lot of a bar, which was active. There were a lot of people there. There were events leading up to the actual murder that perhaps we don't know about that might be significant. Did you talk with him? Did you know him? I mean, who was he hanging around with? All those kinds of things that a lot of people in the bar will have seen and most probably will remember. And just the relaying of those to an investigator, cold case investigator, would be very helpful.
In Kodiak, I'm Diana Gish.
A 21-year-old soldier has been charged with murder in the shooting deaths of his wife and infant daughter in their Anchorage apartment. The shootings happened soon after his return from Afghanistan. Specialist Kip Lynch was indicted today on first-degree murder charges in the April deaths of his 19-year-old wife, Raquel Lynch, and 8-month-old daughter, Kirsta Lynch. Kip Lynch was found severely injured in another room of the home. Lynch, a military police officer, returned from Afghanistan 2 months before the shootings. Authorities say he has sufficiently recovered from his injuries to be charged with the crimes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a family travels 7,000 miles on a bicycle built for five.
It's been tough with the bike because it's been a mechanical nightmare across the country. We've been fixing it all the way.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
A fire today destroyed the Huna Sawmill. The mill building for Icy Straits Lumber and Milling was leveled in the blaze that started just before 6 o'clock this morning. City Administrator Bob Prunella visited the site as Huna volunteers and Forest Service firefighters finished putting out the blaze.
The main building looks like a war zone. It just really, really blew and burned it apart. Other than that, the rest of the operation is okay. The Huna Fire Department did a wonderful job in just containing it to the main building. So the planer and their other buildings and their lumber piles and everything else, they're still operational. I mean, they could be.
No one was reported injured during the blaze. Icy Straits Lumber and Milling is operated by West Hyler of Huna. The mill turns Tongass timber into high value-added products for use by local builders.
I don't know what he's going to do, but I'm sure that the town of Huna will be behind him. Will be behind him. I know I will be, and I'm sure the mayor will be. Huna needs the business. Huna needs the employment. And if anything happens in these small towns, some of which were very dependent upon logging at one time, it affects the whole region. Anytime you lose some employment or a business, it has a regional effect as far as I'm concerned.
Prunella says state fire marshals were expected to arrive this afternoon to begin investigating the cause of the fire. A Craig man is facing federal charges after authorities say he intentionally struck humpback whales while operating a jet boat on two separate occasions. KRBD's Deanna Garrison has this story.
On Tuesday, the U.S. District Attorney's Office filed charges against Kevin Carl in Anchorage's U.S. District Court. U.S. Assistant District Attorney Kevin Feldes says Carl is facing one misdemeanor count violating the Endangered Species Act.
The allegation in the charging document alleges that on two occasions during the summer of 2008, Mr. Carl harassed, approached, and directed a boat at humpback whales.
According to court documents, Carl was driving a 34-foot jet boat for Columbia Helicopters during both of the alleged instances. Carl worked for the company transporting employees and supplies between Craig and nearby Columbia logging camps. In April of 2008, prosecutors say Carl was operating the jet boat carrying employees to a job site. While in Trocadero Bay, prosecutors say Carl saw a humpback veered off course and intentionally directed the boat towards the whale, resulting in a collision with the whale. Later that fall, prosecutors say Carl was operating the same boat between Doll Island and Craig when he again struck a whale. Court documents say Carl turned the boat off course and drove the vessel directly toward a humpback at a high rate of speed. Just as the whale began to dive, prosecutors say Carl knowingly and intentionally hit the whale broadside with the boat. Feldes says there is no evidence that the whales were injured or killed as a result of either of the collisions. If found guilty, Carl faces up to a year in prison and a maximum fine of $100,000. Feldes says Carl has agreed to plead guilty in exchange for 2 years of probation and a $1,000 fine.
Mr. Carl has indicated that he does intend to plead guilty to these charges, and a formal plea agreement has been signed and entered with the court.
Feldes declined to speculate on Carl's motive for hitting the whales. Julie Spiegel is a spokesperson with NOAA Fisheries in Alaska.
You know, these are beautiful creatures, and we're very lucky to be able to view them, and we should be respectful of them and their surroundings.
The humpback population in the North Pacific dropped from around 15,000 prior to mechanized commercial whaling to between 1,000 and 1,200 today, according to the State Department of Fish and Game. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The Naknek Electric Association has started testing on the first well of their geothermal electric generation project near King Salmon. The project has involved a $20 million investment and more than a decade of planning and developing. KDLG's Adam Kane reports.
Because there had never before been any deep well drilling in the region, the state of Alaska required NEA to take special precautions on the first well. The state considered that first well to be a wildcat, meaning that it was unknown what would be found underground. Because of that, NEA had to have the proper equipment in place to deal with the possibility of encountering an oil or natural gas deposit. After nearly a year of drilling, the well has since reached its maximum depth of 10,500 feet without encountering any hydrocarbons. What the project engineers and the roughnecks like Mike Morrison did find was exactly what they were looking for.
See, it's starting to get a little warmer right now, and here comes the zone.
And then, as a gush of water and steam came out of the side of the freestanding drilling rig,
that means success, everybody. It's enough boiling water to power a city.
Powering a city is just the first step for the Naknek Electric Association. Ultimately, they want to provide power to approximately 28 communities in Bristol Bay, including Naknek, King Salmon, and Dillingham. A geothermal well is different from an oil or gas well in that the goal is not necessarily to drill down until a deposit is found, but instead the intention is to find a fault in the stone, which is a source of heat developed naturally in volcanic regions like Bristol Bay. Because the actual depth of the fault is considered to be a trade secret, Morrison wasn't able to divulge that specific information.
Can't tell you exactly where the zone's at, but I'm not supposed to talk about it, but tell you that we're 10,500 foot searching for anything hotter than we already have, but right now we do have hot enough temperature to produce energy. It's getting hotter by the day, you know.
Morrison says that the well is now being cleaned out of drilling mud and flow tested to find out how productive the hydrothermal or hot water source actually is. Flow testing consists of pressurizing the well, which forces the hot water out. Exactly how hot the water is also considered to be a trade secret that Morrison wasn't able to share, but he says that it's hot enough to create energy.
Once you get the well to flow, and we'll put the production stack on it, and we'll keep it flowing nonstop, temperature's just gonna get hotter and hotter because that zone, it's all the zone. Instead of that natural water table that's cold water on top coming out with it, it's just gonna be all hot water coming out of that geothermal zone.
According to Morrison, the natural water table goes down every time the well is flowed, and so eventually the production well will be a closed-loop system in which water is pumped down into the well, allowed to heat up, turning it into steam and generating electricity, before it cools down and is once again pumped back into the well as water. Because the well had to be drilled to the state's oil and gas standards, and because it was the first well drilled by the Naknek Electric Association's wholly owned subsidiary, NEA Geothermal Limited, and for many other reasons, the association's general manager, Donna Vukic, says the cost was considerably higher than the other 4 to 5 wells which will be needed for the project.
It was a learning curve for us, an expensive one, but one that you're going to go through at some point. We also had an oil and gas company man, which made it very difficult when you got to the place where you had lost circulation, which is exactly what you're looking for in geothermal. So there's just a few number of things that really increased it, but we've learned and walked through that step, and now we're moving forward into really being tighter, doing more in-house work.
NEA has purchased the drilling rig and is employing its own crew of experienced roughnecks and a number of local Bristol Bay residents who are in training to work in the drilling industry. Vukic says that when the project began, NEA was spending approximately $75,000 per day, and after streamlining that process and having a better trained and more efficient crew, they've been able to nearly half their daily rates. She says that the first well cost more than $20 million to complete. However, now that NEA owns the equipment and has a well-trained crew, the cost for each additional well should be approximately $7 million. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is excavating soil and cutting grass in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge at the site of a crude oil spill. While cleaning it up, they hope to determine which of four oil pipes are the source of the spill at the Swanson River oil drilling site. The pipe is apparently no longer leaking. The estimated 630 gallons of oil was first reported by Chevron, which is the company that operates at that site. DEC oil spill responder Steve Russell says the area looks like power line right-of-way.
Where there's a clearing approximately 80 feet wide for the length of the power line, and there's chest-high grasses in that area. There's a slight, very slight gradient, down gradient, into a small pond at the bottom of the gradient there.
That pond, the grass, and pipeline corridor are all affected by the oil. But Russell says there is no immediate impacts to the wildlife that frequent the area, which has now been fenced off to help prevent wildlife from entering. Anchorage scored a green energy first this week when two wind turbines rose behind a plumbing and sheet metal business. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
It's a little after 12 noon. Around the back of the two-story building housing Partouche Plumbing and Heating, along with Northern Sheet Metal, a pair of turbine blades lay on the grass under some trees. Metal poles in two sections stretch over the parking lot. Nearby are two wire-sprouting foundations on the edge of the lawn. Terry Bolton, who manages the sheet metal operation and has overseen the technical aspects of the turbine project, gives a pre-raising update.
The guys are getting ready right now. They've got the turbines all bolted on the poles, and they're getting ready to mount the propellers onto the turbines. We're just about ready to go. Hopefully the Alaska crane will be here on time.
How soon after they go vertical do you throw a light switch?
Immediately. They're all ready to go. They're tied to the grid right now. All we have to do is flip the disconnect.
A few minutes later, and right on time, the Alaska crane truck appears. Shortly afterwards, the crew from Susitna Energy System is guiding a lower pole section onto a foundation. The eight-month construction process is coming to an end. Bolton says there were challenges.
One of the major hurdles right off the bat was to find out that our soils are really terrible, so we had a difficult time having the engineers actually come up with a foundation that we could mount these 60-foot poles on.
Larry Patouche, owner of both Patouche Plumbing and Heating and Northern Sheet Metal, says cost savings weren't really the goal when he decided to make his building, the first business in Anchorage on the Chugach Electric Association grid, to install wind turbines.
We install lots of energy-efficient equipment for our customers, mainly through the Alaska Housing Finance rebate program, and it kind of got us thinking that maybe we would do something that's in the future as far as the wind turbines, and thought that we would just try to do something that's green.
Bolton expects that on a few windy summer nights, when the skies are light and the building's use is at its lowest, the turbines could produce more electricity than Partouche needs. In such situations, they might actually be putting power into the Chugach system. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A bicycle built for five is slowly heading for Fairbanks. The Harrison family, they call themselves Pedowins, left their home in Kentucky on August 1st last year. Their goal is Fairbanks, Alaska. The family is pedaling north with three girls, ages 5, 7, and 3. They have less than 300 miles on their 7,000-mile journey. KTNA's Sue Dio caught up with them at the gas station in Talkeetna as they warmed up after a cold, rainy ride.
The Harrison family has stopped to eat hot dogs and sip hot chocolate on a cold, rainy day on their way to Trapper Creek. Their 14-foot-long yellow bicycle with its trailer draws spectators and gasps. The family, Bill, wife Amarence, and the three young children are near the end of their 7,000-mile journey by bicycle. Bill is the team captain.
First and foremost, deep down, I think we're both nomads, gypsies, Bedouins at heart, Amarence and I. And we've been talking about doing something. And January 1 of last year, out of the blue, 2009, Amarence said, hey, let's go to Fairbanks. I said, okay.
Once the idea was born, it took a while to figure out what the mode of transportation would be. Amarence found the idea on the internet, and the plan was hatched. They left Kentucky August 1st, headed to Florida and across the southern part of the U.S. The girls are quick to laugh as soon as they get warm food and hot chocolate. Bill says rain has been part of their life for thousands of miles.
In general, since we left San Diego, we've been in rain and cold the whole time, where normally in a lot of the spots we've been in, it normally is warm and sunshiny, so it's like this cloud has been following us.
He says that he has gotten angry in the past when people ask why they are doing the journey, reflecting on what he says America is made of. It's all about living a dream.
And so someone was asking me, and I was a little perturbed, and I just said, you know, we're turning upside down the Puritan work ethic in order to bring joy and laughter. And I said it tongue-in-cheek, but there's a lot of truth in that. We work so much that we're afraid to get out and enjoy. Now, we've worked our tails off on this bike trip, but we value laughter and joy, and part of a lot of our culture doesn't enjoy that or doesn't value it. So it's been kind of cool to just shuck off, you know, that work ethic that I've lived with since I was 14 years old.
The Quint Bicycle Team will climb the Alaska Range and head through Broad Pass, make their way to Denali National Park, and then head through the Tanana Hills for their final winter destination. The family says the goal is to reach Fairbanks by August 14th. They have to reach the city by that date in order to firm up their winter plans to find a cabin to sit or rent. Bill will work on a book about their journey in the dark days of winter. The family will pack up in spring, buy an old school bus or other such vehicle, and head back to Kentucky, enjoying the sights with a different mode of transportation along the way. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio reporting.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Diana Gish in Kodiak, Matt Miller in Juneau, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Adam Kane in King Salmon, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grantmakers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.